strikes continue today in Greece.
We'll get some perspective from the streets of Athens.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, October 19th.
Coming up, what should we make of the demonstrations going on here in the U.S.?
Stocks have been going up and down like crazy, but really, they haven't moved at all.
And which city has the worst weather in the NFL? I'll give you a hint, Jeremy. It's not Miami.
What a surprise. Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
On the streets of Athens today, just outside the parliament, police have fired tear gas to disrupt tens of thousands of protesters. They're angry over more big pay and pension cuts being debated by the Greek government.
Now, one of the protesters on the streets is Theodora Economides, who joins us now from central Athens in Syntagma Square. Hi, Theodora.
Hello.
Why are you protesting today?
I'm protesting today because the government is about to push through Parliament a new package of austerity measures. And to me, these austerity measures are the straw that breaks the camel's back. It has been very painful for Greek society. For me personally, it has meant, first of all, that I've been unemployed for a year and a half, even though I'm a very educated and qualified person, because there are no jobs. But further than that, what this means to me is that I am watching Greek society fall apart.
What's the alternative, Theodora, for the Greek government if they have to appease the European countries in charge of the bailout?
As I see it, the Greek government does not answer to the rest of Europe or to the International Monetary Fund. The Greek government answers to the Greek people, because without us, these people would not be a government. So the alternative for them is to reject austerity, to explain to the European Union that Greek society cannot take more austerity without a full-blown social explosion, that they need to find a structural solution to the problems of the euro, because this crisis is not only a crisis for Greece. Greece is the symptom of a crisis which is linked to the structural problems of the euro.
Theodora Economides, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, from the protests in Greece to the protests that are going on here in this country, I'm talking about Occupy Wall Street. It's been happening for a month now, and many Americans still don't know what to make of it.
Including a lot of politicians, Jeremy, who are being very careful, as we saw last night in the debate.
Yep.
From Las Vegas, the Republicans were debating on CNN. Moderator Anderson Cooper asked former Governor Mitt Romney what he really thought of those protesters.
You originally called the protests dangerous. You said it was class warfare. You recently sounded more sympathetic. Where do you stand now? What is your message to those people protesting?
We can spend our time talking about what happened 3 years ago and what the cause was of our collapse. But let's talk about what's happened over the last 3 years. We've had a president responsible for this economy for the last 3 years, and he's failed us.
I believe in politics, Steve, they call that a dodge.
Oh, he dodged the question.
Well, to help us understand more about the protests, we're joined now by Todd Gitlin in a midday extra extended interview. Gitlin is perhaps best known for his role as president of Students for a Democratic Society, which was a major force in the big liberal demonstrations of the 1960s. Now he is a professor at Columbia University. Todd Gitlin, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you have some experience in the protest department. When you look at the Occupy Wall Street protesters, do you think this is a movement, a big deal, or, as some have said, this is going to fizzle when it starts getting colder outside?
I think it's a big deal. Whether it's a movement yet will depend on what turns up, because there are a lot of moving parts. There are the members of the inner movement who are occupying spaces. There are the members of the outer movement who make up labor unions and liberal lobbies, Move On, etc. There are the left wing of the Democratic Party who have decisions to make about how to deal with this. The police are always a factor in the growth or retardation of a movement, not always in ways they intend. And then, of course, the political opposition also plays a part in this. So I would say think about it this way. This has all happened in a month. there's nothing like this that happened in the 60s with this rapidity. Hmm. Now, obviously, social media and all kinds of media play a part in it. But still, the degree of intense feeling about it, and by the way, far more intense positive feeling than negative. Quinnipiac did a poll in New York. They say 75% of New Yorkers actually support this movement, which is astounding.
But when you look at the actual numbers, you see, maybe 1,000 people here or 5,000 people there. And I'm thinking back to like the protest before the Iraq War. You were seeing 2 million people in the streets of London, for instance. Is this really as big as you say?
That was a one shot. And there was no follow-up. It was sort of last minute, and nothing that those demonstrations could have done would have dissuaded the Bush and Blair people from going to war. This is different. The issue here is not a one-off eventuality like going to war. What's at issue here is the growing power and wealth of the top 1%. And this took decades to arrive to in its present form and to generate the kind of feeling, mostly hostile, that it has generated. And therefore, it's not going to be settled overnight. It's not going to be settled whether the occupation goes on through the winter or not. So one has to think of this as a movement that at least aspirationally is going after bigger game.
Well, there's been a lot of talk that these protesters really need to come up with a set of demands if this thing is to move forward. Do you think that's the case?
I think somebody needs to. I don't think it necessarily has to be the people occupying the parks, but that what I was calling the outer movement, I think, should cluster around a set of demands. Look at what this movement has accomplished in 1 month without demands. You see, you can't really say that it's failed. I think that it's actually a huge success to get some number of people, not just the few thousands, but many larger thousands, actually discussing what to do about economic inequality rather than discussing the necessity of cutting the social safety net.
Are you saying that the point of this is simply to get the media to focus attention on issues that they haven't already, or to get the people talking in the country about doing things in a different way?
It's the latter. It's to get people talking. And the media are part of that, or sometimes they assist. And I think we're hearing more assistance for that discussion now than the sneering we were hearing originally. But many people, of course, would disdain the media. Many people in the occupations would say, you know, let them do their thing. They're doing what we expect. But I think that there's a firm majority that understands that the population as a whole in some form has to enter into this discussion about what to do about economic inequality.
I've seen criticism that these protesters are in the wrong place, that they should really just gather in Washington and protest the politicians who set the rules and regulations that govern Wall Street. Do you agree with that?
It'll be all over the place. I mean, it's the symbolic power of being around Wall Street is obviously very great and obviously has all kinds of reverberations. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point people materialize in Washington for some specific purpose.
I've noticed in watching politicians talk about this movement that they are being very careful on both sides. Democrats don't want to get too close to the protesters. Republicans don't want to bash them, really. Do you think that there's a risk for each of these sides in trying to harness or stay away from this movement?
You didn't miss the moment when Eric Cantor dismissed them as mobs.
Which he stepped back from later.
Well, okay, sure. People stay back from what they initially say that is actually what they mean, but they're dissuaded by some elements of reality. I think actually there's more to be gained by the Democrats from embracing this movement in its contours, not every detail, obviously, not every picket sign, obviously. But I think that the giant problem for the Democrats over the next year is the so-called enthusiasm gap. I mean, you've got a lot of people who supported Obama who actually did think that he was going to set everything right in a few minutes. And they're bummed out and they've been grousing for months. And now they are excited about something. So that's not a small thing. And the Democrats, I think, would be ill-advised to keep the kind of cagey distance that, for the most part, they have kept. As for the Republicans, I think that they're – you know, the enthusiasm for the Tea Party has diminished a great deal in public opinion. And if the Tea Party wants to identify itself with the plight of the 1%, I think they're making a big mistake.
One of the themes that has gone through this protest is the idea that because of Wall Street, these people perhaps don't have the chance to get the jobs that they would to have a vibrant economy that they would otherwise. Do you think that these people that are protesting, for instance, down in Zuccotti Park would have jobs even if the economy were good?
I don't know. But, I think in a way this is to take this movement too narrowly. The movement is not just against Wall Street. There's a lot of dispute about what exactly is meant by Wall Street. What they're protesting against is a system in which wealth and power are congregated, clustered and concentrated at the top 1%. And that the economic system here is not a job creation machine. It's a profit for financial system machine. And that's accurate. I mean, I don't think that can be disputed. So what their prospects are, I think their prospects are hard one way or the other. I think that we don't understand collectively what the world of work ought to be like. It's not going to return to what it was. Anybody who thinks that the factories of the Midwest are going to reopen as they used to be is smoking something wrong. There is a crisis of both the meaning that people derive from their work and as is true, of course, far more egregiously in other countries, there's a feeling on the part of many young people that they're never going to have steady work in the sense that was taken for granted over a period of decades. So they don't know what to make of that. Nobody knows what to make of that. And that is a subject that deserves the most crystal clear debate. That's the question, not a bunch of idiotic rhetoric about, how great everything that the corporations do is because they're job creators.
How will you know a year from now if this thing has been a success?
Good question. We'll have a richer and more informed discussion of some of these matters, and people like us will take it as a measure of the reality principle of the parties, whether they're actually addressing the real clear problems of the economic system. We've gotten off the debt obsession. We've gotten on to a more sophisticated version of the regulation discussion. And we're growing up.
Todd Gitlin, professor at Columbia University, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
Well, the government said today consumer prices rose in September, mainly, though, because of rises in food and gasoline prices. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, the Consumer Price Index is most important to senior citizens.
Retail prices probably rose about 3.5% over the past year. That'll translate into a cost of living adjustment, or COLA, for Social Security recipients. It's the first time since 2009 payments will rise. Until recently, inflation has been tepid. But MIT economist Jim Peterba says for many consumers, it now feels like inflation's on a tear.
Some very visible prices have increased substantially. Through August, gasoline prices were up nearly 30%. Food that you buy at the grocery store is up about 6%.
Peterba says the COLA adjustment will be a small shot in the arm for the economy.
This kind of a COLA increase will basically help to keep the recipients of Social Security, other transfers in basically a similar purchasing power place. That will, in fact, cost the federal government money in real dollars, but it also will help to sustain demand.
The average Social Security payment in 2012 is expected to rise by $38 a month, or about $455 a year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You know, Steve, when the number for the Consumer Price Index came out this morning, I saw one of the commentators on CNBC say, well, it's up 0.3% for last month. And if you strip out everything I buy, it's up 0.1%. Of course, talking about the difference, if you take out the food and energy, which are so volatile, that's a big part of it. Well, builders began construction of new homes at a faster clip last month, up more than 15%, mainly because of a jump in demand for apartments and condominiums. Now, that's today's big economic news, but if you take the long view, you'll see a stock market that hasn't moved at all this year. That's where we're going to start with Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He is with us from New York, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Josh, if you went to sleep on the very first day of trading in January this year, the Dow was at 11,577.
Right.
And if you woke up this morning before the market opened, you know where the Dow was?
We're pretty much right.
Exactly the same. 11,577. Is it really as if nothing happened?
you know, if you didn't pay attention to anything, if you were in a cave the whole year, you would say, what I miss. However, it's been one of the most volatile years on record. It's been pretty bifurcated. The first half of the year was fantastic, with a few big dips, and then the second half has been extremely volatile.
And what is behind that volatility, that continued volatility, which has now been going on for a few months?
Sure. Volatility is a function of indecision on the part of market players. We're kind of teetering on the brink of either stall speed is what they're saying, or just a resumption of the expansion, albeit at a slower rate. And the market really just doesn't know which it's going to be yet. So that's why you're seeing these monster swings in the market on an intraday, on a weekly basis. It's just total indecision.
Indecision. Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, speaking, Jeremy and Josh, of wild market volatility, 24 years ago today, do you remember where you were 24 years? It was a Monday.
I don't, but I was quite young.
You were quite young at that time. I was, three. No, I was not three. I was actually 17. I can't believe the stocks that day. This was October 19th, 1987. Stocks fell by an average of 20%. I do remember exactly where I was. I was driving the car, and I was listening to a music station in Birmingham, Alabama, and they broke in. They actually broke in and said that the Dow had dropped more than 500 points in one of the biggest crashes since 1929. So this was a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Black Monday. There were a lot of theories, Jeremy, about what happened in those days. Program trading, because computers were relatively new in trading on the stock market floor. Confidence in the market, maybe a bit of a recession beginning there. The U.S. wanting to bolster the dollar. And other countries reacting to that, especially in Europe. So
sounds like a lot of
there.
Things that we're hearing about today.
I know.
When it comes to the market volatility.
It's like,
not a lot has changed.
Not a lot at all.
But you can check out the daily numbers anytime you want at marketplace.org.
And that is something that has changed. You couldn't check the numbers at marketplace.org
That's new.
In 1987.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
And now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. We told you about the protests going on today in Athens. European leaders are scrambling this week to rescue the Eurozone, besieged by huge debt, not only in Greece, but also in Spain, whose credit rating was downgraded by Moody's.
And now a new economics prize announced today asks for the best plan to break up the troubled euro, with a top prize of $400,000. Christopher Worth reports from London.
A member of Britain's House of Lords is looking for ways to put the eurozone out of its misery, even though the UK is not a member of the common currency. Simon Wolfson is the chief executive of the British clothing chain Next, and he's put his own money on the line to entice the likes of big-name economists like Joseph Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, and others to put their thinking caps on and consider how the eurozone might be broken apart in an orderly way.
What I'm hoping for is that we do get the world's best and brightest academics, economic academics, really thinking about this issue and coming up with some good answers.
For example, if Greece were to leave the eurozone, what would happen to everyone's mortgages, denominated in euros but held by banks in France or Germany? The prize could draw at least a few takers. Organizers claim it's the second largest prize in economics behind the Nobel Prize. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Back here at home, Goldman Sachs and other big institutional brokers took a big hit as the stock market plunged this summer. But retail brokerages are reporting a different outcome.
E-Trade unveils its latest profits today, and Charles Schwab reported decent earnings earlier this week, mostly on higher trading volume. They're doing well, it seems, because even in today's economy, or perhaps because of it, more smaller market players are day trading. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
A lot of traders were clicking away on the websites of retail brokerages this summer for a variety of reasons. Many were simply trying to get their investments out of harm's way. But some analysts also credit a surge in traders looking to make a quick buck on the day-to-day swings.
Volatility is one of the best friends of day traders. The more volatility you have in the market, the more opportunities there are for day traders to potentially make money or lose money.
Morningstar analyst Michael Wong notes that TD Ameritrade reported some of the busiest trading days in its history during this summer's market turmoil, likewise Schwab. It's not just volatility that's luring day traders back to the stock market. Wong says retail brokerages are offering customers increasingly sophisticated software.
It's almost leveling the playing field and giving some of the retail investors some of the tools that formerly were reserved only for institutional brokerages and hedge funds.
Surprise, the big guys aren't the only ones using powerful algorithms to suck money out of the market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, now to some evidence, Steve, that old tricks still work. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I went to the supermarket in my neighborhood in Los Angeles, and I was standing in there and looking through the produce, and I hear this announcement come over the PA system. They say, ladies and gentlemen, in 2 minutes, exactly 2 minutes, we're going to be giving away special prizes at the front of the store. This is a product that is never offered here at the supermarket. And I thought, well, I've got to go figure out what's going on. Actually, I'm sitting there sort of debating. Do I go up there or do I – it's just probably some
gimmick.
You were
in the wine section,
whatever.
Weren't you?
I was not in the wine section, but I decided, yes, I'll go up there and find out what's going on. And I went up there, and I can only describe it as a live infomercial. They were basically trying to show off one of those super slicer things.
Wait, there's more.
There's more. Wait, there's more. And it's like the thing that slices, dices, chops, grades, whatever. And so I watch this demonstration, and they give us this little fruit juicer, and then they say at the end of the demonstration, this product, this super slicer, sells for $59.99 on TV,
wow.
But for you here, today only, we'll give it to you for the low, low price of $29.99.
Wow.
Well, I can tell you this morning, I am $30 poorer, and I'm going to be making some killer salsa.
Well, today we found out from AMR Corporation, that is the company that owns American Airlines, that they lost $162 million in the third quarter as fuel spending surged 40%. Most major U.S. carriers, which are expected to record profits, are doing pretty well. But American has a labor problem, and it has a revenue problem too, as Marketplace's David Gura explains.
Earlier this year, many U.S. airlines scaled back. Fewer flights, smaller planes. But American Airlines did the opposite. Analyst Bob McAdoo is with Avondale Partners. He says American continued to add routes to and from five big cities, including Los Angeles.
They were not the biggest in Los Angeles, but if they did this, then they could say they flew to more points out of Los Angeles than did United or did Southwest.
Starting in April, there were new flights from smaller cities like Boise, Albuquerque, and El Paso, niche markets that traditionally have been served by low-cost airlines.
I would describe it as risky, and I would describe it also as a probable money-losing endeavor.
That's analyst Hunter Kay with Wolf Trahan. He says American's decision to keep growing didn't really make sense. There was economic uncertainty. Fuel was super expensive.
The only way that airlines can really control their own fate to the extent that they can is by cutting capacity.
American Airlines went against that conventional wisdom, expanding its network to places like Oklahoma City and Tucson. Kay says the airline had a theory.
Those secondary cities are going to feed L.A., and Americans' hope is that they lose money taking a customer from Boise into L.A., and they make a lot more money taking them from L.A. to Tokyo.
But analysts aren't convinced that'll work. After all, how many Boiseans travel to Tokyo every week? And domestically, American Airlines has to compete with Southwest, known for its low prices and strong customer loyalty, on 9 new routes. Traveler Travis Johnson says he flies Southwest out of LAX about 6 times a year. And he's not really interested in switching.
If they're going to the same place, I would choose Southwest.
Last week, American Airlines made a big announcement. It's cutting capacity by 3%, and it's going to retire several big planes. The carrier is hoping for a better fourth quarter. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The St. Louis Cardinals take on the Texas Rangers in the World Series tonight, Steve.
Yeah.
And we don't know who will win the World Series, but we do know one loser in the World Series,
who's
and that?
That
is one of baseball's oldest habits, chewing tobacco.
Hmm.
Health officials and a few U.S. senators have launched a campaign to keep what's called smokeless tobacco out of baseball. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
Advertising for chewing tobacco isn't allowed at Major League Baseball games, but players are essentially walking billboards, says Danny McGoldrick with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
There's probably no better advertising to a young baseball fan than to watch their heroes using smokeless tobacco.
Consumers spent almost $5 billion on smokeless tobacco last year. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois says many were kids.
Smokeless tobacco use among high school boys is skyrocketing in America. It has increased by 36% since 2003.
Sales to consumers of all ages increased by 7% last year. Advocates like McGoldrick want the Baseball Players Union to ban chewing tobacco on the field and in the dugout.
Players would no longer be serving as a marketing vehicle for this deadly product.
McGoldrick says smokeless tobacco doesn't need any help. It spends $500 million a year on marketing. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Baseball to football now, Jeremy. Finally, the Weather Channel is out with its list of the National Football League's worst weather cities. The cable network factored in, all the scientific-y stuff, right? Meteorology, precipitation, average winds, temperatures below 32 degrees.
I'm guessing that Los Angeles did not have a problem in
Well,
that
they would have to have an NFL
They'd have
team
to have a football
first.
Team. Right? That's true.
So maybe San Diego, not so much.
No, they're
Phoenix,
they're not, in
not so
there.
Much you.
Right.
The runner-up, number two on the list, by the way, was Cleveland, where the Browns play in a place called the Dog Pound, right on the banks of Lake Erie. I've been to that stadium. It's right next to the Jake, actually, Jacobs Field. But the worst NFL weather city in America. Should we do a little timpani? Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo.
Not a surprise. You say
no,
that just like
constant,
you say that like an announcer, Jeremy.
Lake
Buffalo.
Of, you are correct, sir.
You are correct, sir.
It's constant lake effect snowstorms in
Buffalo.
Yeah,
well,
right?
they're in Cleveland as well. The Bills, of course, play at Ralph Wilson Stadium. The locals in Buffalo know it as the Ralph. That's what they call it. Which doesn't sound really colder than the Dog Pound, but when you factor in the wind, Ralph's bite is much, much worse.
Ooh. Well, in sunny, warm Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your day. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.